All right, this is Paige Stewart interviewing Martha Marie Kleinhans for the Time Capsule Project. Hi, Martha Marie.
Hi, Paige.
Hi. So, first question is, what is your CKUT origin story? So, when did you begin? When did you end? How did you get into your position here?
Well, I'm never really great with dates and names. I'm going to be honest with you, but I definitely started before it was CKUT. My origin story was going down into the radio station when it was still CFRM Radio McGill, 91.7 cable. And I went down to see what it was like, in all fairness. A couple of friends of mine had participated and had a show there a couple of years prior, and I'd just come back to McGill. I'd stepped away for a couple of years. And so I wanted to check it out. And I remember clearly walking in and who I saw sitting on that sofa and what the place looked like. And so that must have been about 1985.
Okay.
And it goes 1985, sort of autumn of 1985.
Did you do a show? Were you on the radio?
I did a lot of background stuff. I mean, I tried some of the live shows. I just don't have the... I never felt that I was as expert as other people in providing content. What I loved to do was to do recording and be involved in the production stuff. So a little bit more interested in kind of staffing the control panels then. Reel-to-reel tape decks, taping people and splicing things together and overlaying sounds and being in bands and those kinds of things. So that was a little bit more my speed than the doing a live show.
Cool. So you were the station manager for... Were you the station manager from 85 on, or did you start off as...
Oh, no. I mean, I came in as a volunteer and helped out. And it must have been for about a year. And every year, there were elections for the new executive. And so I decided to stand for the position of station manager. It became quite a divisive time. If I ran on the platform that were I to be elected, we would be putting in an application to the CRTC for a license to broadcast FM. And that meant, and we were really clear, that meant this whole thing is going to change. You'll never elect a station manager again. We would be doing things very differently than we were doing them at that stage. And I ran against a guy named Bernie. What was Bernie's? I don't remember Bernie's last name. I'm sorry. Easy to find. And Bernie ran on the platform of, ain't broke, don't fix it. We're great now. Let's just keep going. Keep on trucking at closed circuit. And we had Bates in front of the entire radio station volunteer population, which would have been about 200 at that point. Really well attended, obviously best attended in anybody's recollection, in which we debated the whole thing. But yeah, we convinced Ray McGill volunteers to vote for us to make that application. And that was just a huge turning point.
That is super cool and amazing to hear you say that, because I've been interviewing so many people, and I think you're the earliest person that I've interviewed, but no one so far has been like, this is how the application started.
Yeah, and it was just an idea at the time. There was no application at that. We never really knew how big this was going to be. It was an idea.
Yeah.
It was a vision, small V vision. It was not something, you know, had we broken it down, we never would have had all the different tentacles that it ended up having.
Yeah. Cool. That leads me perfectly to our next question, which was, did you apply for the license? And what was organizing the transition like?
Yes, we applied for the license. It had to be in my name, actually. The transition, I mean, it took a year and a half. It just felt like that's all we were doing. So the process was, there was an aspect of content for the license application. Mm-hmm. So that was articulating this vision of what CKUT would be. And early on, we got the call sign of CKUT, and there was even a, you know, we had to sit and choose what our letters would be and what letters were available and apply for those. And that was early on. So we always distinguished between what we were now, Radio McGill, and we still are, and what we will be. We will be CKUT. Mm-hmm. And we will now start operating in a sense like we will be in terms of what you can and cannot say. And we instituted a policy of choosing shows based on people's ability to speak and provide what was then called foreground formatting instead of just spinning discs. Then began the big process of sitting down and trying to figure out what that vision written in just a couple of sentences to our electorate would become in terms of breaking down a schedule. Mm-hmm. And I sat down with this was Don Rossiter, actually. Don was my assistant station manager at that point. And my right hand, couldn't have done it without him. And we worked with a law professor at McGill Law School, Frank Buckley, to do all of the content. And we had to put together a schedule of the programming. And so we had to go out and speak to so many people, and in so many different communities, cross-cutting communities, right? And invite so many people to, express an interest in having some airtime, because we were shifting from this, I'm going to be spinning records, which are kind of cool, to I'm going to be providing, a voice, or I'm going to be servicing my community. It was a whole shift in direction. A lot of fallout about that. So there was a plotting of Donnie and myself just sitting there and every day talking about who we spoke to, and yes, they could provide this. And some of the shows continued that had been before, some of the more spoken word shows continued, but it really was about, well, if we're going to do this, how are we going to, and does that achieve what's required by the CRTC? And that was just in content. We put in genuine efforts, put down what we had in terms of commitments, but in no way, Paige, was Radio McGill operating at that level. Mm-hmm. In no way. We looked at other community radio stations. If I were to say who we were modeling after, we were decisively looking at two radio stations. One was Co-op, which was in Vancouver, and one was Radio Centre-Ville in Montreal. So Corinne at Co-op, she was the station manager there, and it was Bruce Girard at Radio Centre-Ville. Helped us enormously talk through their programming, put us in, especially in Montreal, putting us in touch, because Radio Centre-Ville was a francophone light. But we didn't have that running. We slowly started picking up some of those. We would pick up some programming during the year, but we didn't have that space on our schedule. That was, this is what we're going to promise. This is what we will deliver. And then we had to do the other piece, which was to get the money. They told us we had to be self-financing. So we had to run.
Did McGill tell you you had to be self-financing, or who told you?
Oh, sorry. They, yes. CRTC.
Okay.
So this, part of the requirements was that you could not be a radio station that was beholden to another entity deciding what your financing was. So it was a sword, if you will, that we used against the McGill administration. As far as we said, you need, if you want the notoriety of an FM station, you need to allow us to take this to the student body and get separate funding. A fee levy is what we were looking for. Mm-hmm. And at that time, there were only two fee levies in existence. One was the Student Society and one was McGill Daily. And so we had to run a huge campaign. And it's not like Donnie and I had experience in marketing, just for the record.
Yeah.
We had to run a huge campaign to get a student-wide referendum majority vote, which we did get, of $8 a student to fund it. And we were looking at something like $300,000 that we had to achieve. And so that somehow made up the largest chunk of that. And then McGill's board of directors had to approve it as well, which they did. But, I mean, there was, again, opposition, you know, that aspect of an independent from the administration. So there was the financing part. And it was just the little intricacies as well. We knew that we were going to be going up against Radio Concordia, at that time CRST. We needed to show the support as well, sort of the emotional support, not just the financial support. We used the referendum as an expression of emotional support from the student body, but we also ran a campaign of McGill alums. Mm-hmm. And that was Frank, the law professor, who helped us with that, and the Alumni Society helped us with that. They, Gavin Ross ran it back then. They helped us send out and paid for sending letters to every alum in McGill, and this is before the time of email, eh?
Mm-hmm, right.
Asking people to write a letter of support. And it was not just individuals. Then we went and got them across the Montreal community. So, you know, we would ask this newspaper and that radio station and that community group. And we would ask for letters of support for Radio McGill going FM. And they were individuals writing support. And it formed this huge appendix that was bound and presented as part of our application. Yeah, it was a big old project.
That is incredible and inspiring. And you answered like a lot of my questions just in that.
Really? I'll never forget that day of going to Ottawa to present our case. We were just so nervous.
Uh-huh.
We knew there was only, I mean, the background, the context is the CRTC put out a call in those days. They were very hesitant to give out frequencies. They put out a call. They were going to release one frequency in Montreal, and it was 90.3.
Mm-hmm.
They were going to release one, and just one. And so get your applications in, because this is going, and it's going fast kind of thing, right? I want to say that they made clear that they weren't interested in a commercial application. There was no English language community radio station in the province of Quebec. We were sort of at that kind of heyday where campus community radio stations had really started raising a profile in Ottawa. So it was really perceived as a fight between Concordia and McGill. It really was. And that's the way a lot of people, not just within the two campuses, but, you know, the listenership, and really saw it that way, as a fight between the two.
Was it actually, like, was it just kind of a public perception of a fight, or were there words exchanged between the two? Do you know?
I don't remember any sort of antagonism, but we were the underdogs, so It was easy not to be antagonistic when you're the underdog. No one thought we would get it. Everyone thought it would go to Concordia.
Wow.
Oh yeah, everyone. You know, that nod in Vegas were clear. You know, it was like 10-1 Concordia. There was no question. Concordia had been servicing the alternative in those days. That's what it was called, the alternative music community, for years, and mm-hmm. servicing it so well. They were a fantastic radio station for music, because it wasn't just the music. They didn't just spin discs. I told you, I remember clearly the day I walked into Radio McGill. I walked in and the station manager was sitting there with the music director, and I think they were each having a beer. And that's not to say that it would have been different had I walked into Radio Concordia.
Mm-hmm.
But you always had that sense in Concordia that they were there for the local music scene.
Mm-hmm.
In Radio McGill, we were there for ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
It was very self-referential, that radio station. That's not everybody, and it's, you know, not every show. I'm generalizing and I hate doing it, but if you compared the two entities back then, that is probably the way that you would characterize them. A lot of people at Radio McGill were involved in the local music scene, but Radio McGill as an entity really wasn't. They sponsored a couple shows. CRSG had a wonderful program guide that they printed. I want to say a monthly basis, that was sort of self-sustaining through its advertising by, you know, fantastic venue that promoted the Montreal's local music scene, like Foufoune Électrique, which back then was a tiny little room, but they spent their money and supported CRSG. And everyone thought it was going to be CRSG because of that, because of that. And I think in the end, it's because we were better at thinking about the community as larger than the music community. I think that's what it is. CRSG had some of what we would call community programming, but they were really known because of the music community, that that local music scene. And we got it based on a promise, and that was where the resentment was. You know, we got a license because we promised we would do X, and the argument was Concordia is already doing half X, and Radio McGill isn't even doing a tenth of X. But we promised X, and Concordia promised kind of, we're going to do more than what we're doing right now, but look at what we're doing right now.
Wow.
And that the CRTC saw the promise, and they're like, well, that's what you're promising. You know, we're just going to hold you to that. So off you go, folks. Good luck with that.
Okay.
So thanks for holding down the fort, Paige. That's all I'm going to say. You guys have done amazing.
Yeah, it's an amazing place. It's unlike any radio station I've ever heard, honestly. It's pretty... Yeah, I have to
tell you that I do job interviews from time to time in my life, and you know, for what, 30 years, people will ask, "What's your greatest achievement?" kind of thing, and I guess it's more recent than the last 10, but whatever. And I still say that that is my greatest achievement.
Cool.
It was.
Wow.
It really was.
And, well, yeah, and we're all grateful.
The way I express it is, it has evolved and it has become just this most amazing radio station, and now, excitement of all excitements, I can actually find it on my phone.
Exactly.
In my house. You know, I didn't used to be able to do that.
Yeah. Where are you at right now?
I moved to Chicago 2 years ago.
Okay. Wow. Yeah, I mean, a couple of our other interviewees were like, it was all Martha Marie, you should talk to her. And we had found a couple random things in the archives that I think there was maybe like a false start on applying for the FM license in the early 80s, maybe 1980. Yeah. So there was a little bit about that, but I couldn't find anything. So I'm so excited to hear that it was you, and I'm so excited to actually hear the story of how it started.
Yeah, 87, wasn't it 87 we got it? It was awarded?
Yeah, it was 87. It was, I think it was November 87. One of them is, who is CKUT modeled after? And you said Co-op in Vancouver and Radio Centreville. Or what parts of those radio stations inspired you?
What inspired me, because I wouldn't want to speak out of turn for other people, but what inspired me was the creation of a space and an identity that was coming from so many different people and different voices and different ways of speaking and different concerns and different issues. And so I loved walking into Co-op Radio, and I just remember walking through station, and it was just a rabbit's warren of rooms, and in every room you walked in, a different show was being produced that was about something completely different than the other room, and it was, you know, the issues that were being discussed, and it was just so, in those days, it was, we always were looking to be outside of that mainstream discourse, outside of mainstream music. What are the voices that have been sublimated? And so it was always about finding those and listening to those. And so we walked into Co-op, it was Donnie, and we just
from room to room, we felt, wow, well, we're in a space where we actually feel quite comfortable. This is pretty cool. Aren't you loving this? I have no idea about this particular community in Vancouver, and yet I'm spending 15 minutes in it. Fascinating. And we did that at Raja Samsalin as well. And it, just being able to talk with people about different politics. And Montreal was just commercial radio at that point, eh? The Mirror hadn't started yet. None of those alternatives. It was the McGill Daily in terms of alternative politics. You looked to those sources for your different politics. And that was just, you know, the privilege, frankly, privileged white kids hanging out from the university and having a safe space in which to express different politics, but not other communities expressing them. You had to, Quebec was in a really great situation because we had so many other community radio stations. So there was an association, I don't know, called LARC, which was l'Association de Radio Communautaire Québécois. And Radio Centre-Ville was, if not one of the founding, one of the key members, sort of cornerstone members of that association. And they introduced us, Bruce introduced us to other community radio stations in Quebec. In those days, I don't think Donnie spoke French at that point, you know, mm-hmm. And mine was still, you know, lovely and book French. And we just dove right in. And just, oh my goodness, this is fantastic. And there was none of that in the English language. Mm-hmm. It was just like we were all kind of stuck in this horrible mainstream media without ever being able to get away from it unless we had cable FM or were on campuses.
Mm-hmm.
It was also the internal mechanisms of the stations. So, you know, again, back to the beer example,
mm-hmm.
right? And just the way in which, felt that everybody who was there was working towards a purpose, towards a vision, felt there was a different sense in the way that people were working than we had seen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was everyone, you just got the sense that you wanted to jump in and help.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something that we wanted, that inspired us in terms of an internal mechanism for CKUT. So there was sort of the content mechanism and the internal mechanism. And the content as well was also about that going out and the outreach. And wow, right now all we can think about is outreach. Wouldn't it be amazing if we ever got to that point of the Sunsville Co-op where it's not outreach, it's just organic, you know, this constant mm-hmm. flow of people and thoughts and ideas backwards and forwards. It's not an in and out anymore. You know, those mm-hmm. are kinds of the things that we would talk about. Wouldn't it be great if conversations always started that? Wouldn't it be great if?
But you did it.
Wow. Yeah, we did. That's good to hear. Is it still like that?
Yes, it is. Yeah. It's definitely the most incredible workplace I've ever been involved with, and I'm super thankful, and I've learned so much, and they don't, yeah, we still don't make people do things that they don't really want to do. It's
shouldn't.
Yeah. It's yeah. It's pretty amazing.
That's great.
Yeah, it is great. Did it feel like you were inventing something?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. It didn't exist. And, you know, we were really clear about that when we did the voting. You are going to get a very different radio station. Mm-hmm. You need to kind of, here are some broad outlines, but Radio McGill, as it is right now, will stop. You won't recognize it. And we couldn't say it enough. You won't recognize it as mm-hmm. Radio McGill once it's got an FM license and moving. So, yeah, it was inventing. Donnie and I would sit there with index cards with this big schedule that we'd created, the big pieces of paper on the floor of Frank's office in the law building, you know, and put things. Well, which community had we talked to,
mm-hmm.
you know?
that community. Okay, Donnie, you're going to go there tomorrow, right? Yep, I'm going there tomorrow because I'm going to go over here tomorrow. Okay. And we take our little index cards and we say, all right, and hopefully we can give them one of these spots. And literally, it was just for commitments.
Mm-hmm.
We'll talk to you again if we get the license.
Wow.
Well, yeah, it was invented. And those communities had no idea whether we were going to be able to do this or not. And willing to say, yeah, sure.
Yeah, that sounds like a lot of work. I want to know more, if you remember, about the relationship that this whole process had with McGill, or the relationship that CFRM had with McGill versus the relationship that CKUT had with McGill, if you noticed anything or remember anything.
CFRM was, I won't say that they were invisible to, but they were sort of on the par of, as long as you're not doing something horrendous, we're not going to really notice you, because it sat underneath the McGill Student Society. And the only thing that actually forced it to be a little bit more open to scrutiny by the McGill administration was the fact that it did have closed circuit speakers in places.
Mm-hmm.
They were in what were cafeterias in the basement of a vast majority of the buildings. And I want to say there was something like 20.
Mm-hmm.
So there was one in the medical school, one in the law school, one in engineering, one in arts, one in the Leacock, in the business school. And I want to say maybe in some of the halls of residence.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe. Top. The engineering society on several occasions voted to take the speaker down. Sometimes they didn't even vote. Sometimes they just ripped it down.
Whoa.
You know, it was that antagonism of mainstream music versus the alternative music culture. So they did sit in a space that was oppositional. Rita McGill did sit in a space that was oppositional. It was just on the front of the kind of music we're playing.
Right.
So the administration didn't really notice it unless some of those things bubbled up. The big notice was when we went to ask about the referendum. And, you know, that path, I won't say it was paved, but it was certainly softened by Frank Buckley in the law school.
Right.
I think he's at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, by the way. I'm going to tell you a story about him in just a second, but back to your McGill administration. McGill administration was concerned. They thought the radio station was a group of sort of down and out, maybe some of them punk rockers. They annoy part of the McGill student population. How could these people, kids, I would imagine it was in quotes, possibly entertain the idea of doing this radio license? And it was Frank who gave us that professional veneer.
Mm-hmm.
To the administration. I'm sure in back rooms he even said, yeah, they're kids. They're great kids. Something along those lines. They've got some great ideas. I'm helping them. I'm doing the tough, you know, that kind of stuff, right? But he did the kind of handshake, kind of, I'll oversee this from the legal point of view, and from the, and Gavin Ross from the Alumni Society, I'll oversee this from the speaking to alum, making sure everything's on the up and up.
Mm-hmm.
We're speaking the way we should be speaking to people. And, you know, I think we also manipulated quite well in terms of using the McGill hubris on itself. Right? Wouldn't it be great to have it in McGill all across? Not FM. Not at that. McGill, think about the name, not there. So we certainly weren't beneath using that. Donnie and I would laugh about it. But they had to approve. I want to say they had to approve our license application, but no one ever read that. There's no way they ever read it. No, it's 100 pages long.
Yeah.
Frank did a short summary for the Board of Governors. I think in later years it was a little bit more antagonistic. There was some, I heard tell of students trying to rescind the fee
Well, let me tell you my story about Frank.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Donnie and I had been put in touch with Frank Buckley from the law school to help us do this license application. And I want to say we were introduced to him by the full-time staff member, sort of CEO, if you will, of the McGill Student Society. He was the paid employee of the Student Society. And he said, well, there's this law professor up there. I think you guys need to go up and meet him and have a talk. But, you know, I threw the idea out to the law school to see if there was anybody there who could help you with this. So you should go up and check him out. Mm-hmm. And Donnie was had hair kind of out to I don't know where, lovely and curly ringlets. And I want to say his trousers were cuffed up on top of, you know, outlandish socks and some funky shirt. It was just, I am not dressing to go to a law school kind of thing. But he wore a jacket because he was dressing to go to a law school kind of thing. And I was equally differently dressed, shall we say. My hair, who knows what tint it was at that point. I'm sure in those days there was a long ponytail hanging off of the end, you know, one of those little skinny ones that someone could cut off with a pair of hand scissors, children's scissors. And we went to see this guy and, you know, into one of those officious buildings up the top of the hill at the law school. You know, he was in his three-piece suit with, I want to say, a watch fob hanging. And just every inch that commercial attorney sitting behind a desk kind of thing. And, you know, we spoke to him for an hour, and he asked us about the station as we saw it and how we and what we understood about the process. And he said, yeah, well, I'll probably never listen to this stuff.
Oh, my gosh.
But I'll fight for you guys to get this station. And we're like, well, that's okay, Frank. You don't have to listen to it. You got plenty of others that you can listen to. But that would be great if you could help us with this. And so that was always our joke. You know, when we would put something down on the programming schedule, we'd say, so the Homo Show, Frank, you can listen to that? Not going to listen to that. I'm not going to listen to that, Martha Marie. Her story. You can listen to that, Frank? Absolutely not.
Oh, my goodness.
But we can put it on, right? You betcha.
Oh, wow. That is awesome. What a good heart.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. He put in big hours on that. Big hours.
Wow. I wonder what possessed him in this case to do so.
Yeah.
If he wasn't that interested in the programming. Try to ask him. Besides Don and Frank, do you remember anyone else who was around at the time that you were?
At the beginning?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so the kind of transition team, it would be interesting to go back and read that from the CFC documents. Gary Shapiro was one. So he was our music director. And as fun and gruff and kind of straight white boy punk rock that he was, he had fantastic connections to the local music community.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to say he also did a show at Concordia, but maybe not, but he at least knew them very well. Listened to CRSG all the time, but he was going to do it for McGill because he thought we could do it. It was a great station. He just kind of had that loyalty kind of, we could make this happen. He was going to go out and do all his band contacts and open McGill up. This was the perfect opportunity to provide, you know, more space for the local music scene. So he was a huge input on that.
Mm-hmm.
I want to say Chris, but I don't believe Chris was there that early. Ian came in, I think Ian came in after we already got our license, Ian Pringle.
Mm-hmm.
He came in to interview from the McGill Tribune. To interview a group of us. But he was quite key early on in the stages. So there's, I always put Chris McGone and Lisa Weinbaum together because they came in and as forces really helped change the working environment and style in there. You know, because we moved from a very sort of different style of conversation and management at Radio McGill pre-FM
Donnie and I always agreed that I would be the bad guy and he would be the good guy whenever we were talking about things and where we were going. So they were just roles that we set out and we said we would do. I probably achieved bad guy more than I really wanted to. Many would argue that you needed to, but what those expressions like you have to crack some eggs to make omelets, whatever they are. I was young as well, so let's not discount that in the mix. But they were the ones, I would say, and Ian, who kind of brought in a different style of people working there. Mm-hmm. So it was starting to feel a little bit like that. I'm always going to speak my mind. I'm always going to make sure we're clear on what we're saying if we're doing this. But we don't need to be loud and boisterous to do that. And that was something that they brought. It was this strong voice without that kind of entitled loud mouth approach that I felt that I was arguing against when we were putting this forward. I think we shifted into a different mode with that group coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And one that we needed to shift to, in all fairness. Then you just move into the show host and the different connections that they had in the different communities. And, and you know, that one, that Donnie spent so much time on the spoken word components and really putting into practice the promises that we had made and, you know, extending them and just really pushing out the boat and making sure that, you know, if we could give you a voice and you didn't have a voice somewhere else, we needed to give you some space and some time. And, you know, making sure that those voices were there, they were going to be heard, that everything we were doing, we would always challenge. Is this what we should be doing? Looking back to our vision, looking back to the kind of spaces that we want to be creating, is this going to achieve that?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we started with a steering committee that, it was rough going. It was, there needs to be consensus. We've decided this is the right group of people, and now there needs to be consensus.
Uh-huh.
And that was a struggle sometimes, but, you know, you have people fighting for a vision. I'm not going to call it a unitary vision, but it's a vision of the kind of diversity we were trying to be, the difference we were trying to be, you know, the struggle that we were. I think we also like to think of ourselves as in constant struggle. And every decision we made, right, needed to be tested against that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from whether we would sponsor a concert or whether a promoter or some sort of person who wanted to provide funding would be allowed to provide funding. It had to be tested against, you know, what this does to our core principles. We had a statement of principles that we adopted. That was one of the first things about what we were as a station and the kinds of spaces that we were providing and the kinds of voices that we wanted to bring in. And it all needed to be tested against it.
Mm-hmm.
Someone once said that the whole struggle for identity that we did, that we had, that constant, consistent struggle for who we are and what we're going to be, because we were inventing ourselves, right? It was that invention aspect, right? So you constantly had to challenge yourself about the next step that you were taking. It was indeed how we formed our identity. And I don't know, because I couldn't really say what the identity of CKUT is now or what it was 10 years ago. But I thought it was an interesting point for the time. I would hope, if you were to ask me my vision back then for where CKUT is now, I hope it has never, ever stopped struggling. I hope it has never, ever stopped challenging what it is and what it's supposed to be doing with every decision that it takes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we still struggle.
Okay, good. Good. Both in identity forming and in benign ways, I would imagine. But, yeah. You need the latter for the former.
Yeah, it's certainly a good struggle, or good struggles, good problems. As a perhaps a final question, how did what you did at CKUT inform your future endeavors? If any, maybe that's a bad question.
I think it was, I think creating and inventing and building that radio station was the beginning of a kind of trajectory for me that I, you know, in my life I've never departed from. And it has a couple of components. The first is I like climbing mountains. I like climbing mountains for the right reasons, but I like climbing mountains. So give me something, let me identify something that I think should be there or should be done, and I go after it single purposefully. And I enjoy that. That satisfies me. My favorite mountains are the ones that are service, that provide something of service. And so, you know, I went from there to the Montreal Mirror, which was a newspaper founded by some people who had left the McGill Daily and started what was then a monthly newspaper, became a weekly newspaper, a very successful, different style in those days, again, called alternative newspaper. To even going into academia and you know, always being looking for other voices. So I would always do that when I would teach as a law professor. I don't know if you know, I did go back to school and I went to law school at McGill.
Oh, cool.
Weirdly. Frank wasn't there anymore.
Oh, dang.
I did look. But yeah, I went back sort of in my late 30s and did law at McGill and then went on to the UK to do my PhD and teach. And I always did describe it as voices and bringing those things out. And I would always tell the students and that, you know, this space was the space for them to be able to discuss, because you don't, you know, I always saw that academic community and that radio community as spaces in which you just, I guess, the rest of the world, quote unquote, doesn't really get. You know, I would always say, when you leave here, you're never going to be as comfortable as I can make it for you in this classroom. You know, and I've always enjoyed that, and Radio McGill was my first taste of that. You know, and I was, you know, I was coming from a quite privileged space, but when I went to McGill, I, in some ways, out of the norm, but in most, you know, I could still happily wallow in my privilege. But my father was gay, so I was always quite having the component of the LGBT community was an important aspect of my life, and bringing that. Creating those spaces at the radio station where I could always just feel comfortable because, you know, people that were like the ones that I had when I was with my dad, you know, who raised me or were adjunct to raising me with him, I could see and have nearby me. And I did that. I found that I liked creating those spaces. So I did that again, you know, at the Mirror and again in academia. And it's about I think the voices. I still say that. I still use that terminology. It's probably completely outdated, but it is about the voices. And I think the only thing that the only way in which I've changed that some bit has been to allow people to be silent. And that's one thing that we never talked about when we're doing CKUT, because if you're on radio, it's very difficult to promote silence. But I would say that's the one challenge I've given to students when talking to them about creating spaces for voices, is creating space for dissonance through silence.
Right. Wow.
Tough thing to do on radio, isn't it?
Yeah, but it also kind of sounds like a perfect thing for CKUT to attempt. Like, radio's dead, just a silent hour.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay. Well, that is all the questions that I have. That was all pretty inspiring, and I'm extremely excited to have heard your story.
You're very kind. I think there's one rather mundane point that we were really lucky. You know, Donnie and I and the team that worked to run to change the mandate of then CFRM to CKUT, mm-hmm. to the team with whom I worked up until I left. We were just lucky that there were so many people who were willing to share their time and their visions with us.
Mm-hmm.
We just never could have done it without everybody else who, you know, there wasn't a day you would turn and there wasn't somebody else who, oh, thankfully, you know, there's another person who's going to help us. You can't build a radio station without a community who's going to build it. And, mm-hmm. You know, Montreal's community was there. And I thought in the day built a fantastic radio station. And, you know, it's just only when I dip into it, it's just only gotten better. I mean, what a treat. How many people can say that, you know, that they work someplace and they go back and they see it just flowering beyond belief,
mm-hmm.
right? How many people could say that? Very few, I think.
Yeah.